Yes, this is a Friday evening sort of discussion, not a sort of class, but a sort of discussion where I will read a little bit of a sutta because it's a very long one. And today this will focus on the five hindrances. Does that sound like a good theme? So often I veer away from talking too much directly about hindrances because of our tendency to focus on what's wrong anyway. And sometimes it's not helpful to continue to focus on that, but it is good and necessary to get a sense of what these things are so that we can recognize them, we can identify them, learn to work with them, and understand how they are blocking us from the deeper states of meditation, and therefore from seeing things clearly, seeing things as they really are. So I wanted to talk about this a little bit, just to give a small introduction, but basically the idea of these groups is that we share and learn from each other. And so one of the things that happened in the Norway retreat was a nice talk about the hindrances from Ajahn Nito, but he actually opened up for other people to say how they work with them. So I thought that might be something we could do. And also not only how we work with them, what is our attitude to them? For me, this is the more fascinating area. Do we condemn them? Do we want to get rid of them? Do we think we shouldn't be having them? Do we roll in them, even enjoy them? Who knows? So what is our attitude? And we can talk about this and many other things. So you're welcome at any time during the session to write a comment or question in the chat, and also to raise your virtual hand, or your real hand if you want, although it's easier to see you if you raise the virtual Zoom hand. And we'll limit the questions and comments to three each. That's including comments. It's including chats in the box, just so that everybody has a chance to participate. So the sutta that I chose to read from today is the Samanyapala Sutta, and it's Digha Nikaya number 2. It's a very long sutta. The Digha Nikaya means basically the long discourses. And because of that, I'm only choosing a small part of that sutta. But I'll give a little bit of context to how it comes up in the sutta, just so that you understand where these hindrances kind of really become significant in our practice. You know, it's not so much in our daily life, although we do have a lot of hindrances, but sometimes they're more like outright defilement. I don't like the word defilements. They're outright kind of coarse forms of greed or ill will or just complete exhaustion, etc. But the hindrances, when spoken about in the suttas, relate more to the way these things affect us in our meditation, the way they are almost in a way the last kind of barrier to deep meditation. And preceding them, we've already developed a good deal of understanding of the teachings and also quite a lot of virtuous behavior of body and speech, and also sense restraint, learning how to use our minds in skillful ways, not to encourage these hindrances arising in the first place, and to actually learn to decrease the wholesome states by taking a different view, looking at things in a different way, regarding a person in a different way, for example, who we may be angry at. So by the time we actually come to sit down under a tree, as it says in the suttas, cross-legged, straight back, with mindfulness established in front of us, by that time we've already reduced the coarser forms of these hindrances, and what's left to do is to overcome them completely and then to enjoy the deep meditative bliss states of jhana, where a lot of peace is found, precisely because it's in at that time that you know you've knocked those hindrances out for a good long time. And that's one of the defining features of the jhanas, that the hindrances are absent. It's almost like the last kind of barrier to be overcome in order to enter these states. And so they can go from the coarse, as I said, in daily life, where really they're more like just kind of straight out coarse emotions, afflictive emotions, and to the fairly refined forms of those hindrances in our meditation. So the definition. I wanted to just mention the definition that the Buddha gives for the five hindrances. And he says that they are the obscurations of the mind that weaken wisdom and nourish delusion. Obscurations of the mind that weaken wisdom and nourish delusion. So sometimes they're referred to as curtains or veils. Nivarana means something, nothing like nibbana, okay, the opposite. Nivarana means something like a veil or a curtain, something that clouds the truth. It's not something that completely stops you seeing, but it's like you can see something through that veil, but you don't see it clearly, so you might misunderstand what it is that you see. It's like you might see a shape and think it's, I don't know, a tree when actually it's a person, or, I don't know, you see a shadow and you think it's something threatening when really it's just, I don't know, a mouse. So you see something, but it's distorted, it's bent. So they weaken wisdom because we're not able to see clearly. They nourish delusion. And in the suttas, many times people ask, you know, the Buddha, well, what is the cause of delusion? Right? The whole cycle of dependent origination starts with delusion. Delusion is the start of suffering, the whole process of suffering. So we want to know, well, what comes before delusion? And the Buddha said that there isn't a first cause of delusion. However, there are nutriments to delusion, and those nutriments are the five hindrances. So the five hindrances feed delusion, again, by obscuring the truth, by bending the truth, by making it difficult to see clearly and to really know what we're looking at. So anything else I should say? Well, familiarity with them, familiarity with their nature, as I said in the beginning, what causes them to arise, how they make you feel, how to work with them skillfully, what their antidotes are, is a fundamental skill that we need to develop as meditators. And as I also said, it's important also to work on those antidotes, not in terms of trying to get rid of or even kind of overly focusing on the hindrances, but just knowing what the opposites are and cultivating those opposites. And that's what Ajahn Brahm, and I think Thich Nhat Hanh, it probably came from him, calls watering the flowers and not the weeds. Yeah, so we actually water the beautiful qualities in our mind and not overly focus on uprooting the weeds. And yet there is a place to do some weeding from time to time. So hopefully we can do some weeding together and understand these a bit more today. And I will ask you some questions too, such as how do you recognize them? How do they feel? And maybe also looking at their different forms, the coarser forms and the subtler forms that can arise in meditation. What's your attitude to them? What do you do with them? Do you just leave them alone? Do you practice loving kindness? So this is the sort of area I want to cover. Good. So, and if something else comes up that's nothing to do with it, that's okay as well. As long as it's vaguely to do with practice, that's fine. So we're going to read from the Samanapalya Sutta, Samanyapala Sutta, from the section called Contentment. So it's probably about halfway through, a little bit further than halfway through. And the Buddha is talking to the king Ajatasattu, which is a kind of fairly tragic context to this whole sutta, because that king actually came to the Buddha wanting some advice on how to develop in the Dhamma. And Ajatasattu had unfortunately been corrupted by, I think it was mainly Devadatta, but also, was it Devadatta that asked him to kill his own father? It was. So Devadatta was the cousin of the Buddha, and he became a real enemy and went completely off track and encouraged this king Ajatasattu, who used to be a decent king, to kill his own father to take the throne. His own father was actually King Bimbisara, who was a stream winner, I think. And he had some remorse by the time he went to the Buddha to ask him how to deepen his practice or develop a practice in the first place. And at the end of the sutta, it's quite sad because the Buddha gives an incredible teaching and then says to the monks that if he hadn't killed his father, he would have become a stream winner at the end of this sutta. But unfortunately, it was too late. Someone who's killed their parent or done any other heinous crime, like draw the blood of an arahat, which he'd also done, is basically, yeah, blocked from seeing the Dhamma. So they may have to go to unfortunate realms and suffer for a long time before they have another chance. So in a sense, that gives also some guidance for us that, you know, it's important for us to get the benefit of this, to have good sila, good ethics, good virtue. And the whole process depends on that. So here we'll start from the part on contentment. And this is after we've already practiced virtue and we've already established some mindfulness, some basic mindfulness in our day-to-day activities. And how, great king, is the bhikkhu content, or the monastic content, or any practitioner content? Herein, great king, a person is content with robes, so this refers to the monastic, robes to protect their body and alms food to sustain their belly. Wherever they go, they set out taking only their requisites along with them. Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings its only burden, in the same way a person is content with robes, or let's say simple clothes, to protect their body and alms food, or righteously acquired food for lay people, to sustain their belly. Wherever they go, they set out taking only these requisites along with them. In this way, great king, the monastic or other person is content. And then we have the abandoning of the hindrances. Yes, this is Bhikkhu Bodhi's version of this sutta. Endowed with this noble aggregate of moral discipline, I prefer virtue there, this noble restraint over the sense faculties, this noble mindfulness and clear comprehension, and this noble contentment, one resorts to a secluded dwelling, a forest, the foot of a tree, a mountain, a glen, a hillside cave, a cremation ground. Anyone fancy a cremation ground? Oh, you don't look worried about it. Good. A jungle grove, the open air, or a heap of straw. After returning from their arms round, following their meal, they sit down, cross their legs, hold their body erect, and set up mindfulness before them. So see how much preparation's already happened here before we go on retreat, before we come to a monastery, before we do our evening meditation, perhaps. So here, one is ready to abandon those hindrances. Now it says, uh-oh, this is a bad translation too. Okay, I'm going to change certain parts of this because they're translating the first hindrance, which is actually sensual desire or sensory desire, as covetousness for the world, which is a really terrible translation that makes very little sense. And my teacher Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Pramali have railed against for a long time. So let's call that sensory desire instead. Okay. Having abandoned sensory desire, one dwells with a mind free from sensory desire. One purifies their mind from sensory desire. Having abandoned ill will and hatred, one dwells with a benevolent mind, sympathetic for the welfare of all living beings. One purifies one's mind from ill will and hatred. Having abandoned dullness and drowsiness, one dwells perceiving light. Mindful and clearly comprehending, they purify their mind from dullness and drowsiness. Having abandoned restlessness and worry, one dwells at ease within oneself with a peaceful mind. One purifies their mind from restlessness and worry. Having abandoned doubt, they dwell as one who's passed beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. They purify their mind from doubt. So you can notice here that it's not only saying we abandon them, but it's saying what the opposites are in a sense. So one abandons ill will and dwells with a benevolent mind, sympathetic or compassionate for the welfare of all living beings, purifies their mind from ill will and hate. Yes, that's the opposite. And then having abandoned dullness and drowsiness, one dwells perceiving light, mindful and clearly comprehending. So this already gives you a clue as to how to know when those hindrances are absent. And there may be degrees of these things. And passing beyond doubt, one is unperplexed about wholesome states. They purify their mind from doubt. So now we have some very interesting similes. Great King, suppose a person were to take a loan and apply it to their business, and their business were to succeed, so that they could pay back their old debts and would have enough money left over to maintain a partner. I'm a little bit disappointed by the gendered language here, I have to say. I thought it would be a bit more updated, but anyway, I'm trying to make it gender neutral and inclusive. They would reflect on this, and as a result, they would become glad and experience joy. Again, Great King, suppose a person were to become sick, afflicted, and gravely ill so that they could not enjoy their food and their strength would decline. After some time, they would recover from that illness and would enjoy their food and regain their bodily strength. They would reflect on this, and as a result, they would become glad and experience joy. Again, Great King, suppose a person were locked up in a prison. So this is the sloth and torpor now. After some time, they would be released from prison, safe and secure, with no loss of their possessions. They would reflect on this, and as a result, they would become glad and experience joy. So the next one is the restlessness and worry. Again, Great King, suppose a person were a slave without independence, subservient to others, unable to go where they wanted. After some time, they would be released from slavery and gain their independence. They would no longer be subservient to others, but a free person able to go where they wanted or want. They would reflect on this, and as a result, they would be glad and experience joy. And lastly, the simile for doubt. Again, Great King, suppose a person with wealth and possessions were traveling along a desert road where food was scarce and dangers were many. After some time, they would cross over the desert and arrive safely at a village which is safe and free from danger. They would reflect on this, and as a result, they would become glad and experience joy. In the same way, Great King, when a person sees that these five hindrances are unabandoned within themselves, they regard that as a debt, that's for sensory desire, as a sickness, that's the sickness of ill will, as confinement in a prison, that's sloth and torpor, as slavery, that's the restlessness and worry, and as a desert road, doubt. But when they see that these five hindrances have been abandoned within themselves, they regard that as freedom from debt, as good health, as release from prison, as freedom from slavery, and as a place of safety. And from here starts a beautiful causal sequence, which you may have heard before. When one sees that these five hindrances have been abandoned within themselves, within oneself, gladness arises. When one is gladdened, rapture arises. That's piti. When their mind is filled with rapture, piti, their body becomes tranquil, pasaddhi. Tranquil in body, I actually think this should be body and mind, pasaddhi. They experience happiness, that's sukha. Being happy, their mind becomes stilled or serene. Here it says concentrated. But the result of happiness is that your mind settles, quietens, stills, and goes deep inside to some very blissful, serene places, free from thought, free from anything close to the hindrances, and actually free from not only the sensory desire, but the sensory world. So that means the world of the five senses and the world of thinking as well. And the next part of this sutta goes on to the jhanas, which then happen as a natural course. So happiness is the proximate cause for stillness, which means samadhi to the extent of the first jhana, sama samadhi. So that is usually the sequence in these suttas on the gradual training. And you can see that it's these hindrances that really, are in the way in a sense, but also whose abandoning gives rise to a great deal of happiness. And I love those similes because you can really sort of sense how that does feel, maybe from your own life, if you have been in debt and suddenly you've paid it off, you know. Or maybe you don't have money in your bank, but you get your paycheck. I don't know if that's quite the same simile, probably not. but, you know, one minute you were angry, you were sick, you were ill, gravely ill, gravely ill, you know, unable to even breathe properly because of your anger. And then you feel rather benevolence, freedom from sickness, good health. And you're full of loving kindness instead. So this is the little part of the sutta that I wanted to focus on today and see what we might have to share about how we work with these things and how we recognize them, etc. So I'll open it up first of all and later on maybe come back to my questions. But anything anyone would like to say either about the sutta, about their practice, about any of the similes, how does that resonate for you? Is it clear? Joseph, question number one.
Thank you, Venerable. What's really, I feel inspired to share is the Dhammapada verse where it says, contentment is the greatest wealth. So that feels like a really nice pairing with the idea that covetousness or sensory desire is a debt. Mm. So maybe talking about contentment as well, how that pairs with that teaching, right? So how can we feel that great wealth of contentment that frees us from debt?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that is true. I never made that association between the debt and the wealth of contentment, but I often think of contentment as the antidote actually to every single hindrance. And often I think of it as the obvious antidote to restlessness. To me, that's a kind of experiential, experience, because when we're restless, we're simply discontent. We're looking for something else. We don't want to be here. We want to be anywhere except here, whether it's the past and it's something terrible in the past, or it's the future and you don't even know what's going to happen, but you'd rather be anywhere but here because there's simply no contentment with the present moment. We're looking for something. It's like a wind that blows you away from the moment and into the realm of the past and the future. So contentment helps us to deepen a sense of happiness with where we are, a sense of this is good enough, this is enough for me. But yeah, in a sense, the first two hindrances are the major ones and the other three are kind of variations on the first two. So certainly contentment can be an antidote also to craving. I mean, if you're content, then there are no desires. Right? And that's where in the third noble truth, if you look at it carefully, it's all about letting go. It's all about freeing ourselves from wanting, being content. Yeah. So even letting go is a kind of contentment. You have enough. It's easier to let go when you have enough, right? When you have something really valuable inside, you don't need to grab on to all these external things to make you happy because you already have a kind of source of happiness inside. So yeah, for me, if I'm really deeply content, sensory desire is not only not necessary, it's actually extremely agitating and it doesn't feel like a pleasant experience at all. So I think it's a very good antidote for greed, but unfortunately it's probably more the case that a lack of contentment gives rise to greed quite often, and developing contentment can be sometimes a little bit challenging when greed is there in the mind. Yeah. Can I come to Shirley? Oh, did you raise your hand there? Yeah. Okay, just after Shirley.
Thank you, Joseph, for raising contentment and my favourite verse in the my whole favourite verse in the whole of the scriptures. Contentment is the greatest wealth. And thank you, Venerable, for expanding on that, particularly in the context of restlessness, because yeah. I'm quite a restless being. I should perhaps rephrase that and say
yes.
My restlessness, but there is a lot of restlessness in me a lot of the time. But
restlessness arises a lot.
Yes. but lately, over the past couple of weeks, I've had quite a lot of agitation, which is different from the restlessness, because I've confronted some difficult situations which have upset me quite a lot, and it's a different texture. So actually, I've really looked at that and really tried to find out what it's about, and it actually it does come from a lack of contentment, because it's really about how I want other people to be, or the world to be, or how, perhaps above all, how I want people to see me as a nice person. And criticism in a group or organisation that you've worked hard for, and then somebody says, actually, what you're doing here is really quite bad. It's, you know, the agitation just arises, and people mm-hmm. say, well, let go. And I say, well, no, I'm going to let be. Well, if you let be, then it'll go away. And I'll say, no, I'm going to let it be for as long as it wants to stay. And I have, you know, and then also I have practiced metta towards myself. And when it started off, I thought, shall I put that I'm agitated? And I thought, no, I'm going to put that I'm grateful for being in this group, because I think there is a time when one turns aside to what is good and one's own goodness. I would very much appreciate some, you know, when one experiences this criticism of oneself or a group that you value, and you have this sort of really strong agitation in the belly, or this is what I've experienced, and you know how you deal with that. I mean, I think you can
is that the question
understand I think you can develop insight by actually looking at that and asking where it's coming from and where the craving is.
So what's the question, sorry?
That's the question. Sorry, I'd just like some general advice on dealing with that sort of situation.
Yeah.
Because I haven't, meditation's been very unpleasant, but I've just tried to be with it. And to sort of actually, you know, I think what's often advised is just to sort of focus on the breath. And that would just be a fight for me. So
I have to stay with
what's in the belly. And then the mind goes off into proliferation, that we'll just then bring it back and just try and practice kindness and a bit of gratitude as well. So that's what I've been doing to answer your question. But I would also like some reflections from you on that whole situation of this agitation that can arise. So thank you.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to breathe. And I think that's also a good way to deal with agitation, is sometimes just to slow down a little bit, just to slow down a little bit, because it is upsetting when we feel criticized. But it was interesting that I picked up in your, I don't know if this is really the case or that's what they said, but you actually didn't say they criticized you. You said they criticized your behavior. They said that your behavior was not good or something like this. Maybe, no. All right. Well, okay. Whether they said that or not. But I think if you can depersonalize it a bit to see that, okay, it's not me as a person that's being criticized. It's something that I've done that may have not been you know, what they wanted or skillful in their eyes. Because one of the reasons we get so agitated is precisely that self-view, you know, you said to in the beginning of your sharing that it's important to you, your image in the eyes of others is important. You're not alone with that, I'm sure. We all want to plant a good image of ourselves in the eyes of others, right? And it's when that gets threatened that we feel extremely distressed. But this is actually nothing personal. Often it's not personal. It feels personal. We can take it personally. But to notice that it's that sense of, you know, self, basically, and self-view that's been hurt. And that is one of the causes for the agitation. So maybe sometimes a little bit of reflection on non-self and the conditioned nature of, you know, our behaviors and our actions and the fact that this whole thing is out of control, we're doing the best we can given our conditions, you know, we can connect again with our intentions. Were they positive? Could they have been, you know, more compassionate or kinder? Maybe not. But right now we can be kinder to this whole conditioned process that we take to be a self. So I think definitely metta, focusing on your breath. I mean, maybe if you see your thoughts going out of control and, you know, the thinking is going very fast, or you're kind of thinking in a way that's creating more suffering, you can just literally stop and pause and just but actually trying to focus on your breath when there's a lot of other disturbance in the mind is really pretty much useless, and it would just entail a lot of force. For breath meditation, we need to be in a place of relative ease. The mind needs to be relatively subtle, so we don't need a lot of force. So I think you're doing the right thing by letting things be and not letting them be to get rid of them, but letting them be genuinely to say, okay, how can I be of service to you? How can I understand you? How can I give kindness to you right now? That might mean the thoughts. That might mean you yourself. That might mean the emotions that arise. So I think that's very skillful. And I don't think you should rush it either, you know, or wish it away. Because there's always something to learn. But we can't learn straight away. I mean, there may be something in what they're saying that is useful. And if not, you can let it go. Once you've examined that in yourself, then it won't matter so much what other people say. Yeah. I hope that helps a little bit. Yeah. Okay, so we have three hands up in the room, but I'm going to come to Erica, who's here with us. If you can speak a little loudly, or yeah, come up a bit closer so people can hear your question or reflection. And then I'll come to people on the Zoom. Yeah, thanks.
I was just thinking about the English translations for the five hindrances.
Yeah.
And also words like greed and sloth are part of like the seven deadly sins. And I guess kind of like in the English speaking world, that's like, okay, but God will punish you if you have them. But I wonder if that connotation would exist at the time of the Buddha, or like, what's like the value? Is there like a value judgment in the...
No, I actually don't think there's a value judgment. Did you all hear the question, first of all? Yeah. So where's like sloth and greed are kind of deadly sins in the Christian tradition? And is there a value judgment in the way the Buddha's framing this? So I actually don't think the Buddha makes a value judgment in many places at all, other than to warn us from generating and doing anything that will cause suffering. I think his whole concern is with what causes suffering and what doesn't. And even with a king like Ajatasattu, who came to see him to ask about all of this, he was so compassionate. He didn't judge him. He didn't say, you're a murderer. You've murdered your father. How can you even be here? I have to tell you off. He didn't do any of that. He just taught the Dhamma in the way he would to anyone else. You know, that when this arises, it's like a debt. When the other arises, it's like a sickness. He's trying to point again and again to how it causes us suffering. So the last thing he wants to do is judge, because that's more suffering. He wants to help us with ways to come out of all suffering, which is to inspire in the Dhamma, teaching the Dhamma, and to, yeah, give us a way to get inspired and enthusiastic about overcoming these hindrances. So, yeah, great question. But I think actually the Buddha's teaching is largely, if not entirely, free from value judgments, other than what is for our own good. Yeah. thanks. Benjamin, can I come to you?
Hello.
Hi.
I don't have this very clearly formulated in my mind, but I'll try and make it clear. I'm thinking about sloth and torpor, which I often do. First of all, I think it's interesting that they're grouped together because in my mind, they're two very different things.
Yeah.
I think of sloth as being sort of kind of deliberate, like you're actively being lazy, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Whereas torpor seems to me like more of an external condition that you're experiencing. But that's sort of an aside. The main point I'm interested in is, well, as you know, I'm not a very well person.
Mm.
I have a disease that essentially creates permanent sloth and torpor.
Yeah.
Or dullness and drowsiness. And on the one hand, I'm aware that theoretically you can go through the whole path regardless of physical condition. In my favorite verse in the Tirugata is, as I was going for alms, leaning on a stick, all my limbs trembled, and there I fell on the ground. As I saw the danger in the body, in that moment my mind was liberated.
Because
there's documentary evidence of someone becoming enlightened by being ill. But so far, for 20 years, my experience has been that actually disease is the limiting factor in meditation practice. So there's a certain tension there between what's theoretically possible and what I've found to be happening.
Right.
And there was something else I wanted to say about that I can't quite think of at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, firstly, I just want to validate your experience and say that I absolutely agree that sometimes physical illness can be a limiting factor, or even the limiting factor that you just mentioned. You know, it certainly makes it harder. There's no doubt about that. I mean, you know, even the Buddha really didn't ask us to sit through pain. He tried to ensure that we are comfortable and encourage us to be comfortable and find bodily comfort before we meditate. So it was important to a sense of well-being and ease. But it doesn't mean that, you know, that we're not developing really strong qualities through practicing. It just might mean that the results don't show as quickly, or that there might be fewer occasions for us to really kind of have a lot of momentum, a feeling of momentum in our meditation. But it's all about how we relate to the sickness in our body, how much acceptance we can develop, how much we can recognize that this is just conditions. It's nothing to do with you. In that sense, you're completely right about sloth and torpor being slightly different, although I would even say that mental torpor is still conditioned. It's still nobody's fault as such. I mean, you could say it's on purpose, but I mean, it's the best people can do. Maybe they just are feeling lazy due to various reasons. And I think for both physical and mental torpor, the results or the remedy is similar, which is to take deep rest, whether it's physical rest or mental rest. We just have to respect that. Last year during the rains, for about a month and a half, I was sleeping for about 9 hours in the night and about 4 hours in the day. I was absolutely exhausted. I was fasting as well, but my body was just kind of recovering from loads and loads of overwork and burnout and all kinds of things. And sometimes I noticed this thought arising, oh gosh, I'm just sleeping through my retreat, you know, I'm not really developing my mind, etc. And I was like, no, this is your body. Your job is to surrender to the body without, you know, let it humble me. Let it just humble me, and don't make a self out of it, and just serve my body with what it needs. And we develop qualities that way. It's like we might not see the deep meditation at that time, but over time, when conditions change, you'll find you've developed a lot of good qualities. And I know that it feels difficult when, you know, we don't see a change for a long time in a single lifespan. But I do think the idea of the practice going on beyond one life can be really helpful there. You know, if that's something that you can even entertain as a possibility, that can bring some relief as well, because we're all going to have to face these things. And, you know, people who have had perfect health and a lot of time to practice sometimes are complacent because of that, and then when they do get sick, they suffer a lot and their practice goes through the floor, you know, It happened in the Buddha's day. Somebody who had deep samadhi suddenly got sick and felt his practice crumbling, and the Buddha told him off. He said, when did I ever say that the practice was all about states of mind? You know, you have to see these five khandhas as an affliction, as a dart, a boil, as alien, as not self. Contemplate in this way. So there are different practices we can do, and I'm sure you're doing that. And if you're keeping your virtue really strong and, you know, keeping a sense of kindness and compassion towards your body and mind, and realizing it's nothing to do with you, you know, it's causes and conditions that are beyond your control, then I think you're still developing very well on the path. So I don't know if that really helps or answers the question. Did you remember the other aspect of the question?
Yes, I did. The other thing was on a more optimistic note, I suppose. What I've found recently to be working well in meditation practice, in particular working with the hindrances, I think, is I've observed that there's a certain sense I can get of, I'd call it resistance. And I can notice that there's some resistance somewhere in my being to something.
Yeah.
And so, for instance, the big thing for me is how long I sit meditation. And I can sit for a certain time and then I feel, oh, yes, I'm starting to resist sitting on some level. So now I need to stop. And that seems to be also a very effective way for me to work with all the different hindrances. Is they also manifest as a feeling of resistance somewhere in the system. And I'm starting to hit on the skill a little bit of noticing the resistance as it arises and either releasing it in some way.
Yeah.
Or if I can't do that, then just stopping and doing something else.
Yeah, great. Perfect. It reminds me of the phrase, Mara, I know you. You know, this resistance is Mara trying to stop you, trying to block you. And yeah, sometimes just saying, Mara, I know you, I'm not going to kind of, you know, listen to you at this time, it will work. And other times it will be a fight. So it's better to just stop, change, do something else. Exactly. You know, maybe reflect on some teachings or maybe play some chanting or whatever. Just go about your day, you know, mindfully. Or phone somebody and say something kind or whatever else it is. So, yeah, I think there's a skill in knowing when to sort of continue, that it's not actually hurting us physically or mentally, and when to stop, when that becomes a kind of fight. And you have to use will, you have to use the sense of self to continue, then it's better to maybe relax. So yeah, but I also hope that, you know, it can be possible to perhaps experiment with the continuity in different postures, you know, so that if you are tired of the sitting and it doesn't feel like something that's healthy to resist the resistance to, that you can maybe change your posture or just try to intentionally sustain a more meditative state of mind whilst moving into activity or even just sitting on the bed or whatever you have to do. You know, this also can be good. So it's still your period of meditation in your mind. Yeah, great. And I do also think that on the positive side of things, working with sickness and, you know, the inevitability of our deterioration, basically, we're not going to get more energetic as we get older, probably, is a massive, powerful practice. It's not a pleasant one, perhaps, but it's powerful, it's real, and it's connected with reality, it's connected with suffering. So you are developing a lot of strength. And you make beautiful calligraphy of the Terigata, which brings a lot of joy. Alexander, can I come to you? You're next on my screen.
Thank you. Hi. I mean, for me, it's dealing with worry, because I found anxiety and worry managed to creep into my mind, and then I'm suddenly worrying and I don't even know it, and other people notice it before I do.
Right
now I can't get out of my head again. So any advice would be appreciated.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these things, someone was asking, I think Erica was asking me earlier about, you know, the difference in a sense between the sort of different forms of the hindrances. And I think sometimes, you know, they do just arise circumstantially in response to something very obvious, like you see a chocolate cake, you feel greedy for it or something like that. And at other times it's things we keep on defaulting to because they become almost entrenched as habits. So it sounds to me like that's more of a habit. And I mean, in my family, there's a lot of that as well. It tends to be the default, even if there's good news. Oh, but I don't know how long the good news will last, you know. There's always something to worry about. You can find no end of things to worry about. So with things like that, it might be, of course, first of all, recognizing that you're swimming in it so much that you don't even notice it. And it does take a good friend to say, actually, this is worry. There could be another response. So it's helpful if other people could point that out. And then maybe doing a bit of, you know, thinking around it. Sometimes the mind's thinking anyway, so it's good to challenge the thoughts and sort of say, okay, so, you know, is there really anything to worry about here? Is this just a sort of habit of mine? What if things do work out? Isn't that also possible? And find some evidence for that. You know, maybe take an instance in the past when you had a worry and it didn't come to fruition. Maybe remind yourself that the past, the future, everything is uncertain, especially the future. Ajahn Brahm often defines worry as like relating to the future with negativity, thinking of all the things that will go wrong. So maybe start thinking of some of the things that could go right as well. I think another thing to start getting familiar with the arising of worry is to become more embodied, to maybe start to sense in your body where you feel that worry. You know, how does it start? Is there some energy or some mood there already that's predisposing you to have a more worried sort of day? Sometimes it's a grogginess or a feeling that we're under-resourced. You know, we kind of feel like one more thing and we're just going to have too many worries. Sometimes there is a subtle anxiety there that, again, we might not be aware of if we're in our head. So see if you can get into your body a little bit more. And also metta meditation, which is an antidote not only to ill will, but also to fear, because worry is obviously fear-based. And metta, again, is more like looking at things through positive eyes. So doing some loving kindness as a regular part of your practice before you have the worry, but even when you have it, sometimes you can like, oh, you know, may I be happy, may I be free from this worry, this is suffering, let me be kind to myself. You know, what kind of words do I need to hear that are going to soothe this worried mind right now? And see if you can offer yourself that. So, yeah, there's a few ideas, but yeah, be very patient, because these habits are, I mean, it's incredibly common, but also they take time to build and they take time to change. So even if you just starting to notice it is a really big step. So very well done.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I'll come to Johnny and then to the chat. Oh, have I got to unmute you, or can you? Yes.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Good to see you all. Hey. So, one comment to begin with. I find that if I want to feel better in the short term, meditation's not the best way for me to do that. Going for a run is by far better, or some other vigorous exercise. And I find it actually helps both with sleepiness and agitation. In quite like a deep way, I can really feel that there's a kind of, I don't know, flushing out, that if I'm just doing a sitting practice, it'll just kind of rattle around inside my
head.
So I have a couple of questions. Is that all right to just put them out there?
Please.
Okay. So
I might just stop you after the first if it's a long one, so I can remember.
Okay, sure. Okay, we can go one at a time. So I'm interested in, for you in your practice, are there any antidotes to the hindrances that you've found that are not found in the suttas?
Ah, interesting. Ah, I'd have to think about that, wouldn't I? Well, I think what you mentioned about running, I would consider that a daily life kind of way to manage kind of the moods and the energies and the kind of different states of mind. Again, as I said in the beginning, I think when the Buddha's talking about the five hindrances in this context, he's talking more about something that we're meeting through meditation. It's kind of like working with the subtler, the remnants of the hindrances that have already been weakened by our sila, by our virtue, by our lifestyle. And exercise is part of what I would consider a compassionate lifestyle, like a healthy lifestyle. So actually, it's interesting you mentioned exercise, because I find the same thing, like in the morning, especially after the work meeting where I have to think of so many things and organize the sort of the morning. My mind is kind of tired already, like decision fatigue already. Maybe it's just the wrong time of day to have to make decisions because I've hardly woken up. And if I have a jog, which I haven't been recently, but if I do, I feel really clear. It's amazing. And if I just carry on, no matter how much mindfulness I use in my work, it's more of a struggle. So yeah, that's an obvious, nice release. But I wouldn't say that's working with the hindrances in the context the Buddha's speaking of now. So in terms of the second part of the question, anything that's not in the suttas that I work with? I mean, a lot of the things, it's not that they're not in the suttas, but I mean, I think we find our own creative ways to apply the principles of the Dhamma. So things like sort of wishing oneself well or meeting the suffering with kindness. I mean, the Buddha doesn't exactly say that, but he does talk about right intention and about attitudes of kindness and compassion. So is there anything that's not in the suttas? I mean, I do think actually having phrases, it's not directly in the suttas, but then there are suttas about, you know, removing an unwholesome thought by putting in a more wholesome thought. So that I would try, especially if it's some kind of repetitive, a hindrance in the form of thoughts. We haven't really spoken about this, but a lot of hindrances, let's say thinking is full of hindrances. Like it's almost entirely hindrances, at least restlessness, right? Restless thoughts. So to slowly, slowly calm them down is really helpful. But gosh, you've really got me there. I'd have to think about that. Is there anything that's not in the suttas? Yeah. I mean, daily life things, obviously, like stretching as well is really good. Spiritual friendship, but that's in the suttas. I think he covers a lot. So although it might not say exercise, I mean, in a way it does actually, because it talks about going for arms around, walking to the village, being aware while moving forward, moving backwards. Yeah, bringing mindfulness to everything we do. So although it's not expressly there, I think it's still skillful. All right. Was that the only question or was there another question? Because we've got a few questions adding up here.
Yeah, sure. There is another, but that's fine.
Okay. If it's a quick one, I'll give it a go. How many questions have we got?
Okay. How are the metaphors in the sutta useful for practically overcoming the hindrances?
That's what I wanted to ask all of you.
I'm so sorry.
You don't have to say sorry.
I've totally stolen your thunder.
I wanted to hear from all of you about how those metaphors make sense or not. Yeah, maybe that could be your homework and we could talk about this next week about the metaphors. What do you think? Would that be a good idea? Yeah, is that a good idea?
Yeah, I don't know if I'll be here next week, but
okay, but you can hear the recording. Yeah,
can I? Nice, that's interesting news.
I hope so. We'll record it anyway.
Okay, fantastic.
Is that okay? Do you mind me skipping because it's a big
yeah, no, that's actually fine.
I will like to hear from all of you. I'm coming to the chat and then to Sunma. Okay, for a while I've been suffering from sleepiness when I wake in the morning, meaning I couldn't practice samatha or mindfulness effectively. To start with, I was disheartened and cross with myself, but now I find metta meditation is perfect first thing in the morning. Yay! This is how we customize the practice to suit ourselves. First thing in the morning, and I practice samatha or mindfulness later in the day when my mind is brighter. The change in routine now suits me very well. The operative word being now suits me very well. And later, when it doesn't suit you, please change it again. So very good. That's excellent. Yeah. And by the way, metta is a form of mindfulness and a form of samatha. So actually, there's no wonder that your samatha and mindfulness have been given a boost, because you've added to the samatha and mindfulness right intention as well. So metta meditation is awesome. And it does brighten the mind. It does soften the mind as well. So excellent. Yeah. Very good. I'm coming to Summa now. Hi.
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 The question of debt.
Debt.
A hindrance is like having a debt.
Yeah.
I listened to a bhikkhu talk about this in regard to the training. And I was totally perplexed. I could not wrap my head around how can you put debt together with hindrances? So I can start to investigate what's the debt, where is the debt, and wrote about it, but I don't remember it right now. I'd have to look at it, and I can't look at you and look at that.
Sure.
It's in my computer. That I wrote it in word processing. So still, whenever I hear debt associated, it just drives my brain crazy.
Interesting. Yeah.
I just can't feel it. I can't feel where.
I feel that, yeah.
What's this debt in regard to
An
adjective?
Okay, yeah. I mean, I could say a little bit about what I understand there. And I think for me, around sensuality, sensual pleasures, it's something to do with how bad you feel when you lose it. So it gives you a kind of short-term happiness, but then you can get addicted to that, or you can get dependent on that. And then when it's not there, you feel even worse than you did before. So in other words, you have to kind of pay it back with more suffering. So does that make sense?
Yes, very much. And I have experienced that, yes, yeah. Of course. The conditioning, sensual pleasure is one of the hindrances for me I can identify that has not left me.
Right.
I'd say ill will also on the level, the subtle level.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, oh, those SOBs. I see their suffering.
Yeah.
I can see their suffering, but I also get agitated.
Sure.
Political here in Israel. I mean, hey, you know, everybody know what's Israel. It's like a sandwich. It's become a sandwich for people. It feels like you're in a sandwich.
Yeah.
You read all the stuff. I try not to read all the stuff.
Yeah. That's probably wise.
Yeah. But I notice it's something subtle, subconscious, or conditioning when you're meditating that breaks the samadhi. I mean, it's kind of
yes.
Vibration.
Yeah.
Thing. But here again, do thoughts ever really stop? I mean, I have experienced a stop. They do stop. I think I can verify that. Yeah, they do stop. But then it's something, sometimes a feeling.
Yeah.
In the body.
Mm-hmm. It's like there's something bubbling up. Some kind of...
Yeah, but it's bubbling up. It never really
explodes
because you're in samadhi or entering.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Half-half.
Yeah.
In and out. It's
like they've not been fully kind of quelled. Yeah, which you think is, you know, the case until you're in incredibly deep samadhi. And, you know, even before sort of jhana samadhi, I have experienced having no thoughts for extended periods of time. But then, of course, they can easily resurface You know, they're never that far away. I mean, if the mindfulness is really strong, you can keep them at bay for a long period if you've got really good conditions. And this is after several months of practicing in Burma where I had nothing to think about and they just kind of stopped.
Right.
But of course, there was still a bubbling from time to time. And it's not that they weren't there between the meditation sessions. They would still be there because there's just something about the sense of self and the wish to be that has to keep on thinking. You know, that's one way that the self expresses itself.
Yeah.
So we think we're ready to like relinquish the sense of self, but it still wants to express itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was just going to say, because I'm listening to what you're saying, and I can identify with it.
Yeah,
the conditions is very important.
Yeah, it is. It is everything, in every way. In every way. But I think, you know, what you say about the craving and the ill will, I mean, they are the main hindrances and we can't really fully overcome them until like the third stage of enlightenment. So they're going to be there. And it's really, I also like what you said about, you know, the vibrational sort of experience of these things, because they can be that subtle, just like a stirring up inside.
But it's sort of like if you're scratching a lot, you know, that's the subtle to me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
my experience over years, whatever.
Yeah.
Or if you have to move, or you have to, your eyes are going somewhere.
Absolutely.
Or you're actually, you're identifying the sound, not just the sound. It's the subtle hindrance. That's what that.
Yeah. It's very subtle. And it's the thing that takes you out, like you say. The thing that takes you out into the world. That's why Ajahn Brahm likes to translate the first hindrance as sensory interest also, like any interest even in the sensory world.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for that. It's really great. All right. I guess last question. So would it be skillful to investigate if there are six kinds of contentment? Based on being six times of craving, you can if you want. It sounds a bit complicated to me. Wouldn't we be content with one kind? Can't we be content just with one kind of contentment? Do we need to have six? You can be content with different things, but I think contentment's contentment, and it usually spreads to everything. Would our hearts be free of craving for sights, sounds, tastes, touches, and ideas, especially mean they're perfectly content? Being free of this. Yeah. If you're perfectly content, then you don't need any kind of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, or ideas. And that's why at the end of the life, you just don't need to take a rebirth. You don't need the senses anymore. You don't need to have a brain that thinks. You don't need to have a sense of, you don't need to be. Yeah. To use positive language like you often recommend. Yeah, that's nice. In other words, our hearts are perfectly content rather than our hearts are free from craving. Yeah, I agree completely. I think the highest happiness means the happiness of contentment, absolute peace, full contentment. Sometimes if I really want to do metta, like with a bit of a oomph, I say, may I be profoundly peaceful. May I be completely content. Because that to me is the most beautiful state of mind. Even just thinking about complete contentment is just so fulfilling, so enriching that, yeah, of course, there's just nothing else you need ever again, let alone input from the senses. Yeah, that would just take you out. Yeah, glad, Shirley. I'm sure you're on the right track. I think when you said letting be rather than letting go, and also not letting be to get rid of, that's really key. So very good. Excellent. We're actually going to end on time. So, wow, there's a lot more we could say about all of this. I don't know. What do you think, people, if next week we would continue on this theme and maybe talk about the similes more and maybe give you some homework to bring some examples? Just check out in your life whether you notice some of these hindrances arising and you can see them as a debt or a sickness or as a, what are the other ones? A slavery or as being in a prison or being lost in the desert. Of course, you might have other observations throughout the week that, you know, come up. So note them down, and maybe we can have some little breakout rooms as well, so you can discuss a bit with each other as well. So please do that. Otherwise, I'll be left with nothing to say. and we'll meet for some discussion. So tomorrow morning, I'm teaching metta meditation for anyone who wants a morning boost or an evening boost if you're in a different country. Or a very early morning boost if you're in Canada. And tomorrow afternoon we have a special Vaisak celebration with myself and Aya Ananda Bodhi. She'll give a little Dhamma talk about the Buddha's life and what inspires her about Vaisak. Vaisak is the celebrating the Buddha's birth and enlightenment and everything else, as in passing away to Parinibbana. And yes, that's at 3:30 in the afternoon, British time. And then what else? Oh, Monday evening I'm teaching in Oxford, but that's only for people in Oxford, I guess. But that'll be recorded. And then I'll see you next week. Okay? Excellent. So, Manari, would you like to say a few words too?
Yeah, and thank you again very much. For this lovely teaching on hindrances. I was remembering those PowerPoint presentations that Ajahnita was putting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so for all of us, I'd like to say a few words about generosity. And giving develops wholesome qualities that form the foundation of our Dhamma practice. And the Buddha said that the wisest way to give is when one gives with a heart full of joy for the purpose of beautifying the mind, for equipping the mind for the practice of serenity and insight. Anguttara 8.33, which is a lovely passage. So generosity can also be a practice of checking in deeply with us, like what would it be to give for the benefit of all, yet expecting nothing in return. So here at Anukampa, we offer several ways that we can cultivate this beautiful quality of giving. As you know, there can be a one-time donation through our website, a bank transfer, a PayPal, or a SumUp, and or else a regular donation through your banking institution, like standing orders. And if it is not finances, you can do like a drop-in or online volunteering, maintain the monastery. There may be different things that you have strengths, and if you have some time, you can volunteer that specialties and the time for us. For us means Anukampa. And you can provide meals to the monastics, either in person or via cooked meal delivery. You can do a supermarket delivery, groceries, and there's a list of needed items on the website as well. And you're always, invited to check for special retreats. In the online, you can see in the Facebook and the website. And also a good way is to see the newsletter. Wishing you all in a practice, and see you next week. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Manuri. And just to say, for anyone who hasn't got the link yet for tomorrow afternoon, you do have to register through the link that's on the website. So if you go to our events page, and you scroll down to the Vaisak, I think it's called like Meditate Like a Buddha. So you're all going to be enlightened tomorrow. Meditate Like a Buddha. You can press the button and register. It's donation based. So all you have to do is just register. And then basically those messages that people have registered come to the Zoom account. And I just have to press the button and you get your link. But I haven't had time to do that today. So anyway, if you feel like, oh, has she got my registration, register again. I'll look at it right now and I'll look at it tomorrow morning. Okay. So no one should get left out. So I hope I see many of you tomorrow. Take care, everyone. It's lovely to see you, and wish you a lovely evening or morning or wherever you are. So we usually unmute you all now and you can hear each other's voice and wave goodbye.